On to the fourth and final of our little series of talks on the Jatakas, especially this particular set of Jataka stories, paradigm. And just to refresh your memory, and just for summary for those who haven't been here before, is that when recently just reviewing the Pali Jataka collection, I noticed that there was a series of stories which dealt with a quite a similar kind of paradigm or pattern of story, and that pattern revolved around one crucial motif, and that was a woman or a female character who had some kind of desire, some kind of insatiable longing, and insatiable and irrational longing. And to me, this was quite an interesting motif, as it reflects a whole lot of preconceptions and ideas about how women are seen and depicted and so on. And the surprising thing, or the interesting thing to me, was that when if you hear that idea that these stories are based on the irrational and insatiable longings of women, then you kind of get the impression that there's probably it's probably giving you quite a negative perception about what they're doing. But when you look at the stories themselves, very often the what you're actually seeing is something quite different and quite a powerful and very positive outcome is found in these stories. Not all the time, but sometimes. So I've been going through these gradually and kind of working my way up through the different versions of the story, starting with the lower forms of the story, ones more like the basic folk tales, animal tales and things like that, where you have, for example, a crocodile who longs for the heart of a monkey, and gradually working through more sort of human-level ones, the outcast wife who longed for a mango, and then to the higher forms of the story, which we'll be talking about today. Now, I read one of the high forms of the story yesterday, last week, and I can't remember for me which one it was. The last one, was it? The Vimala Nagarajini? Yeah? Okay, that's what I thought it might be. Okay, so that was that one. So today I'll read a few of the other high forms of the story, and we'll get an idea of that. And I'll start with Jataka number 281. And this is the Abhantara Jataka. Story: the master told in Jetavana about the elder Sariputta giving mango juice to the sister Bimbadevi. Okay, so of course Bimbadevi being the Buddha's former wife, often known as Yashodhara and other names, but Bimba also being one of the common names. Have we had any stories featuring her before in this thing? No. She's in a few of the background stories, so that's why I ask. When? Was she? She's in a few of the background stories. Yeah, okay, maybe so, yeah. When the Supreme Buddha inaugurated the universal reign of Dhamma while living in a room at Vaisali, the chief wife of the Gotama clan, with 500 of the Sakya clans, asked for ordination and received ordination. Mahapajapati is of course talking about the story here. The 500 sisters became saints on hearing the preaching of Nandaka, it's in the Nandaka Vada Sutta. But when the master was living at Nyasavati, the mother of Rahula thought to herself, "My husband, on embracing the religious life, has become omniscient. My son too has become a monk and lives with him. What am I to do in the midst of the house? I will enter on this life and go to Savati and will live looking upon the Supreme Buddha and my son continually." So she betook herself. And interesting kind of motif here is that she says she's the fully enlightened Buddha and her son, Nibbadhang. She'll attach to them, she'll dwell watching them or looking on them. This reflects on the idea which I've I've argued that Mahapajapati, one of the reasons for the ambiguity of the Mahapajapati story was the feeling of her parental attachment to Siddhartha. Okay, so she took to a nunnery, entered the order, and went and lived in a cell in Savatthi, in the company of her teachers and preceptors. Beholding the master and her beloved son, the novice Rahula came and saw his mum. One day, his sister was afflicted with flatulence. The bimba. Udaravato. You really wanted to know that, didn't you? Yeah. And when her son came to see her, she could not get to see him, but some others came and told him she was ill. He went in and asked his mother, what do you need for your illness? And she said, my dear, at home that this pain would be cured, but was cured by mango juice flavoured with sugar. But now we live by begging, and where can we get that? The novice said, I'll get it for you, and departed. Now the preceptor of Venerable Rahula was the captain of the faith. His teacher was the great Moggallana, his uncle was the Venerable Elder Ananda, and his father was the Supreme Buddha. Thus he had good luck. However, he went to no other save only his preceptor, and after greeting him stood before him with a sad look. That's Sariputta. Why are you sad, Rahula? Sir, my mother is ill. What must she take? Mango juice and sugar? Okay, I'll get some. Don't trouble about it. The next time he took the lad to Savatthi and went to the palace. The king of Kosala bade the elder be seated. At that very moment, the gardener brought a basket of sweet mangoes ripe for food. The king removed the skin, sprinkled sugar, crushed them off himself, and filled the elder's bowl for him. Interesting that this kind of motif of sprinkling the mangoes with sugar. And it's not something which you'd think about these days, would you? That usually mangoes, if they're ripe, are very sweet. And so why would you sprinkle them with sugar? So possibly the mangoes in those days were a lot less sweet than they are today. The elder returned to the place of waiting, gave them to the novice, bidding him give them to his mum. And so he did. No sooner had the sister eaten than her pain was cured. The king also sent messages saying, the elder does not sit here to eat the mango juice. Go and find out whether he gave it to anyone. The messenger went along, found out, and returned it to tell the king. And the king thought, well, if the Buddha had become had stayed in the laid life, then he would have been a universal monarch, and this sister would have been his treasure, the empress. This bhikkhuni would have been his treasure, the empress. I must go and attend upon them. Now they're living close by. There is no time to be lost. So he constantly gave the mango juice to the elder. And then the monks talked about this in the Dhammasala and about how the Venerable Sariputta had gone to such lengths to make sure that Bimba was looked after with mango juice. So that's the background story. So interesting little background story on a number of levels, but you have, of course, the longings of Bimba here. Of course, here they're not irrational longings. It's a longing for a medicine which, you know, she had found to cure her previously, but still that motif. But also very interesting to note how the monks were so solicitous in looking after her well-being and going, making sure she had the medicine and things like that. But then that becomes the occasion for telling a story of the past. Not only this time, monks, says the Buddha, was Rahula's mother comforted with mango syrup by Venerable Sariputta. The same happened before. And he told them a tale of the past. Once upon a time, when Brahmadatta was reigning in Benares, the Bodhisattva was born in a Brahmin family living in a village of Kasi. When he grew up, he was educated at Takasila, settled down into family life, and on the death of his parents, embraced the religious life as a rishi, took the rishis going forth. After that, he remained in the Himalayan region, cultivating the faculties and the attainments, that means the various jhanas and so on. A body of sages gathered around him, and he became their teacher. At the end of a long time, he came down from the hills to get salt and seasoning. And so this is a classic motif that we find again and again, that the sages would live up on the roots and fruits in the mountains, and after staying there for a long time they'd need some salt and some other kinds of foods and variation in their diet, and so they'd come down to the plains to get that. In the course of his wanderings, he arrived at Benares, where he took up his abode in a park. And at the glory of the virtue of this company of holy men, the palace of Sakash, Saka reflected and perceived what it was. He thought, I will do an injury to their dwelling. Then their stay will be disturbed. There will be too much distress to have concentration, and then I'll be comfortable again. All right? So Saka, of course, always plays quite an ambiguous role in these stories. So very often he's the protector and the good guy, but he's not too good. And there's still the kind of the memory of this thing. It is, of course, a very common motif in Indian mythology, is the jealousy and competition between the gods and the sages, because the gods, of course, ultimately got there where they were because of their practices in the past lives. And so they're always looking out for who's going to best them and who's going to get rid of them. This is a kind of a variation on the theme of the killing of the divine king. Because the gods have their time is meted out for them. Eventually somebody's going to do them in, replace them. Okay. Then he thought about how to do that and hit upon a plan. Okay, an upaya. I will enter the chamber of the chief queen at the middle watch of the night. Hovering in the air, I will say, "Lady, if you eat an inner mango, you will conceive a son who shall become a universal monarch." Okay? An abhantaramba. An inner mango.
Who is he going to say
that to? The chief queen.
I thought he was trying to get rid of him.
Yes. We haven't yet revealed the whole depths of his plan yet. This is only the beginning. She will tell the king. He will send to the orchard for a mango fruit. I will cause all the fruit to disappear. They will tell the king that there's no fruit. And when he asks who eats it, they'll say, "The rishis." So, just in the middle watch, he appeared in the queen's chamber, hovering in the air, revealed his godhead, and conversing with her, repeated the first two stanzas. There grows a tree with fruit, with divine fruit. Men call it the inner mango, and if one be with child and eat of it, she shall therefore bear one to hold the whole wide earth in fee. Anyway, if one is a dohalini nari, okay, so here's this dohalini again, the word dohala, which we found. Lady, you are a mighty queen indeed. The king, your husband, holds you dear. Bid him get the mango for your need, and he, the inner fruit, will bring you here. And this is what Saka recited to the queen, bidding her to be careful and make no delay, but to tell the matter to the king herself, encouraged her, and went back to his own place. So this kind of scheming and conniving on behalf of the gods is very reminiscent of Greek myths, where they're always doing this kind of thing. Next day the queen lay down as though ill, giving instructions to her maidens. The king sat upon his throne under the white umbrella and looked on at the dancing. Not seeing his queen, he asked a handmaid where she was. "The queen is sick," replied the girl. So the king went to see her, and sitting by her side stroked her back and said, "What is the matter, lady?" "Nothing," she said, "but I have a craving for something." Dohalo me upanno.
This is a repetition of the last one with the sage. The lying down, the king comes in.
Yep. Yeah. What do you need, my dear? I need an inner mango. An inner mango? Where is there such a thing as an inner mango? I don't know what an inner mango is, but I do know that if I don't get one, I shall die. All right, we will get you one. Don't you worry about it. So the king consoled her and went away. He took his seat upon the royal couch and sent for his courtiers. "My queen has a great craving for a inner mango. What is to be done?" Someone told him, "An inner mango is one which grows between two others. Send to your park and you'll find one mango growing between two others. Pluck its fruit and let us give it to the queen." So the king sent men to do after this manner. But Saka, by his power, made all the fruit disappear as though it had been eaten. The men who came for the mangoes searched the whole park through, and not a mango could they find. So back they went to the king and told him that there were no mangoes. Who is it that eats the mangoes? Asked the king. The rishis, my lord. Give those rishis a drubbing and bundle them out of the park, it says. That's the word, Pali word for drubbing here. So the people heard and obeyed. Thaka's wish was fulfilled. The queen lay on and on, longing for the mango. The king could not. So at this point, the Thaka's plan has worked, right? He's got what he wants. The rishis have been kicked out of the park, and because they've fallen away from their meditation, he's not being disturbed anymore. But the mechanics that he set in motion keep on going. So this one's a little bit unusual in that it originated with Thaka rather than originating with the woman. The queen lay on and on, longing for the mango. The king could not think what to do. He gathered his courtiers and his Brahmins and asked them, "Do you know what an inner mango is?" Said the Brahmins, "My lord, an inner mango is the portion of the gods. It grows in the Himalaya, in the golden cave. So we have heard by immemorial tradition." "Well, who can go and get it? A human being cannot go. We must send a young parrot." Now, at that time there was a fine young parrot in the king's family, as big as the nave of the wheel in the prince's carriage, strong, clever, and full of sharp devices. Upaya Kusala. Okay? Skillful and skilled in means. This parrot the king sent for and thus addressed him. "Dear parrot, I have done a great deal for you. You live in a golden cage, you have sweet grain to eat upon a golden dish, you have sugared water to drink. There's something I want you to do for me." "Speak on, my lord," said the parrot. Where are we now? Eka Suvapotaka. "My queen has a craving for an inner mango. This grows in the Himalaya, in the golden mountain. It is a portion of the gods. No human being can go there. You must bring the fruit back from there." "Very good, my king, I will," said the parrot. And the king gave him sweetened grain to eat on a golden plate and sugar water to drink, and anointed him beneath the wings with oil refined 100 times. Then he took him in both hands and, standing at a window, let him fly away. The parrot, on the king's errand, flew along in the air beyond the ways of men until he came to some parrots which dwelt in the first hill region of the Himalaya. "Where is the inner mango?" he asked them. "Tell me the place." They said, "We do not know, but the parrots in the second range of the hills will know." The parrot listened and flew away to the second range. After that, he went to the third, the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth range of hills. And there too, the parrot said, "We do not know, but those in the seventh range of hills will know. So he went there and asked where the inner mango grew. And they said, "In such and such a place on the golden hill." So of course, they've now gone to the seventh layer, so this is the number seven being always of great symbolic significance. The entire world cycle, the cycle of birth and death, the cycles of creation, they've crossed over the whole world. They've gone into this mystical realm, a place where no man can go, no human being can go. So this is, of course, the great quest for the treasure. "I've come for the fruit. Take me there and help me get the fruit. That is the portion of the king Vesavana." Okay, one of the four great divine kings. "It is impossible to get near it. The whole tree from the roots upwards is encircled with seven iron nets. It is guarded by thousands of millions of Kumbandha goblins. If they see anyone, he's done for. The place is like the fire of the dissolution and the fire of hell. Do not ask for such a thing." Okay, so again, this is a classic mythic motif, the treasure which is hard to gain. The more worthwhile, the more precious something is, then the more effort there is, the more danger it is to get it. But he said, "If you will not go, then give me instructions." So they told him how to go there. He went, he listened carefully. He did not show himself by day, but at the dead of night, when the goblins were asleep, he approached the tree and began softly to climb on one of its roots, and then clink went the iron net. The goblins awoke, saw the parrot, and seized him, crying, "Thief!" They discussed what was to be done with him. Says one, "I'll throw him in my mouth and swallow him." Another says, "Oh, crush him and knead him in my hands and scatter him in bits." The third said, "Oh, split him in two and cook him on the coals and eat him." This is exactly
what happened when poor old Hobbit got busted by the trolls in The Hobbit, yeah? Bilbo Baggins. And, this is very much so. So, he said, "I say, goblins, whose men are you? We belong to King Vesavana." And he said, "Well, you have one king for your master, and I have another king. The king for Benari sent me to fetch a fruit of the inner mango. And then and there I gave my life to my king, and here I am. He who loses his life for parents or master is born at once in heaven. Therefore I shall pass at once from this animal form to the world of the gods." And he repeated the third stanza. "Whatever be the place which they attain who by heroic self-forgetfulness..." Renunciation strives with all zeal a master's end to again to that same place I shall soon win. After this fashion he taught, the goblins listened and were pleased in their heart, and they said, "This is a righteous creature, we must not kill him, let him go." So they let him go and said, "I say, parrot, you're free, go unharmed out of our hands." "Do not let me return empty-handed," said the parrot. "Give me a fruit of the tree." "Parrot," they said, "it's not our business to give you fruit of this tree. All the fruit on this tree is marked. If there's one fruit wrong, we shall lose our lives." Again, this is all very much like the adventure, especially in The Hobbit, if you remember when Bilbo stole the little cup from the huge mound of treasure in the Lonely Mountain guarded by the dragon, and he just took one tiny little cup out of this whole massive mountain of gold and everything. And of course when the dragon saw that he'd taken just one little cup, he immediately recognised it, said, "Who's taken my cup?" Some things you just don't forget. That was when he was in the middle of the Lonely Mountains hiding from the orcs.
He found it
in the tunnel, yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, and that's the great thing about the Lord of the Rings as a story is it turns this whole motif upside down, because instead of going to win the treasure, they go to throw the treasure away.
Yes.
So it actually completely inverts the whole thing. Okay. So we can tell you where you can get some. "Okay, I don't care who gives it, but the fruit I must have. Tell me where I may get it." "In one of the torturous paths of Golden Mountain lives an ascetic by the name of Jyoti Rasa, the essence of the flame. He watches the sacred fire in a leaf-thatched hut called the Kanchanapati, or gold leaf. He is a favourite of Vesavana, and Vesavana sends him constantly four fruits from the tree. Go to him." The parrot took his leave and came to the rishi. He gave him greeting and sat down at one side. The rishi asked him, "Where have you come from?" And he said, "From the king of Benares. And why are you here?" "Master, our queen has a great craving for the fruit of the inner mango, and that is why I've come. But the goblins would not give me any themselves, so they sent me to you." And the rishi said, "Sit down then, you shall have one." The four which Vesavana sent arrived, and the ascetic ate two of them, gave the parrot one to eat, and when this was eaten, he hung the fourth by a string and made it fast around the parrot's neck and let him go. "Off with you now." The parrot flew back and gave it to the queen. She ate it and satisfied her craving, but still, all the same, she didn't have a son. Bummer, eh? So Sakasme heard his promise, because of course Sakasme made this false promise, it was only his plan, and notice again this word Dohala, which only occurs in this context, and which is often interpreted by the translator as being pregnant. And in the verse here, when it occurs, it says, if a woman is with child and she eats it, then she will have a wheel-turning monarch as son. And he's translated Dohalini as if meaning one with child. But actually she isn't with child, it seems. So the dohala seems it's associated with pregnancy in some way, but actually just means one who has this kind of wish. Now, when the master had ended this discourse, he identified the birth in these words. At that time, Rahula's mother was the queen. Ananda was the parrot. This is another word for parrot, is Sukho. Sariputta was the ascetic who gave the mango. So the rishi was Sariputta. And the ascetic who lived in the park was I myself. Okay. So interestingly that the Bodhisattva himself played a relatively minor role in the story. He was the one who was chased out of the park. Okay, so there's another version of the story. So what can we learn from that?
It just seems like you can get what you want by someone, just sort of get to the right person.
It's just who you know, yeah.
Yeah, it's who you know. It's not what you know. She didn't get what you wanted.
Hmm?
She didn't get what she wanted. No, but I was getting the mango, the way the carrot was stretched.
So how is that story different from or similar to ones we've looked at before?
It starts out, and also, interestingly enough, the Dolphala is not irrational. So the Dolphala comes from a rational desire, but so in the other story, I guess, like there's this mystery behind the dohala. But in this story, we know exactly what that dohala comes from, and it yields a completely different fruit.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. It seems to be it's the very fact that it is rational.
Yeah.
That means that's why it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because Saka tells her, if you have this, then this will be the result. Yeah.
Didn't he say it while she was sleeping?
Was she still sleeping or did she wake up?
Basically makes a suggestion to
it. Yeah, no, it seems that she was awake. Yeah. But it's kind of like that still. It's still kind of like that, isn't it? Yeah, certainly.
The desire is not for the
man, but
the desire is for
the
son.
For the son, yeah.
But that's a bit like how, meditation, if you have an expectation of what you're going to get, and then you're not going to get anything.
Oh, you probably get something, you get a bit of frustration, some fuel for the fire. But it's interesting, like the motif of Saka appearing there is one of the, it's like an example of how, a masculine figure. Saka is kind of the paradigmatic masculine figure. He's the warrior god and so on. Has usurped the tale. You know, I think we've seen enough versions of this story to agree that it's fundamentally a woman's story. It's the story of a woman and her wishes. But he's kind of usurped it, and in the act of usurping it, he stuffs it up, twists it around. Okay, maybe we'll have a look at some more and see some other variations on it. Yeah, well, he did, yeah. Conscious lie. Okay, so I'll look at more at one. He had to get rid of the rishis. He had to get rid of the rishis because otherwise they were going to dislodge him from his seat. Yeah. In the Indian mythology, like whenever there is anyone particularly virtuous or something like that, then Saka's seat starts to heat up and becomes unbearable. And very often, he'll actually go and help the person. It's like a sign for him, and he'll think, oh, there's a really good person, I'll go and help him. But in this case, he obviously was feeling a bit insecure and so on, had to go down and get them off. So he plays a very ambiguous role like that. One could draw some points of comparison there. Okay, so we can move on from here. We'll go to the Chadanta Jataka, 5:14, and this is the six-tusked elephant. And we can see here, and I've rated this as one of the high forms of the myth. It also has the word Dohala in it. Comes in a dream. The motive is vengeance, and she gets her desire, but she dies heartbroken. And the motif is cruelty. So this is it's a high form of the myth because of the characters and so on, but it's not successful in terms of actually achieving her desires properly. Now, a girl of good family, Atsavati, and this is the story the Buddha told about a young bhikkhuni, okay? Dahara bhikkhuni. Girl of good family, Atsavati, they say, recognizing the misery of the lay life, embraced asceticism, and one day went with other sisters, other bhikkhunis, to hear the Dhamma from the Bodhisattva as he sat preaching from a magnificent throne and observing his person to be endued with extreme beauty of form arising from the power of illimitable merit. She thought, I wonder whether in a former existence those I once ministered to were this man's wives. Then, at that very moment, the recollection of former existences came back to her. In the time of Chadanta the elephant, I was previously existing as this man's wife. At the remembrance, great joy and gladness sprang up in her heart. In her joyous excitement, she laughed aloud as she thought, few wives are well disposed to their husbands. Most of them are ill disposed. Bit of worldly wisdom there. I wonder if I were well or ill-disposed to this man. And calling back her remembrance, she perceived that she had harboured a slight grudge in her heart against Chadanta. Perhaps more than a slight one, as we'll see. And the mighty lord of elephants, who measured 120 cubits and had sent Sonatra, a hunter, who with a poisoned arrow wounded and killed him. Then her sorrow awoke and her heart grew hot within her. And being unable to control her feelings, she burst into sobs. On seeing this, so this is this young bhikkhuni who's come, she's sitting to the Dhamma. First of all, she just breaks out in cackles of laughter, and then she bursts out in tears. Everyone's sort of wondering what this mother's on about. On seeing this, the Buddha smiled. And the monk said, what, sir, was the cause of your smiling? And he said, monks, this young bhikkhuni wept on recalling a sin she committed in the past against me. And so saying, he told the story of the past. Now, this is quite a bit of a long one. I'm not sure if I can get through the whole story here, but I'll probably have to summarise it. It's got some very interesting bits in it. So, one time there was 8,000 royal elephants that flew through the air using their psychic powers, and they dwelt near Lake Chadanta in the Himalaya. And Bodhisattva came to life as the son of the chief elephant. He was pure white with red feet and face. When he was growing up, he was 88 cubits high, 120 cubits long. He had a trunk like a silver rope, 58 cubits long, and tusks 15 cubits in circumference, 30 cubits long, and emitting six coloured rays. He was the chief of a herd of 8,000 elephants and paid honour to Pacheka Buddhas. His two chief queens were Chula Subhadha and Maha Subhadha. And the elephant with his herd, numbering 8,000, took up his abode in a golden cave. Okay, so here obviously we have a mythical beast living in this golden cave, which we've already heard about and we'll hear again, and obviously a very mystical location. So when we're hearing these kinds of motifs, we're a long way from the kind of the low story of the crocodile and the monkey, yeah, or the chandala sneaking into the king's garden at night. We're in a highly mystical realm already. And he talks about here the Lake Chadanta. Chadanta means six-tusked, and it goes on describing the lilies around the lakes and things like that, and the sugar cane and so on and so forth, and the seven ranges of mountains. Again, the seven ranges of mountains rising 7 leagues high, and then the tree, great banyan tree, 5 leagues in circumference and 7 leagues in height, and so on and so forth. And And all of the stuff. So if you want to read all of the details, you can come back and check those later. And he went with the herd to a sal grove, and where the sal trees were blossoming. And he knocked one of the sal trees with the front of his head. And at that moment, Chula Subhadra stood to the windward, and dry twigs mixed with dead leaves and red ants fell upon her body. But Mahasubhadra stood to leeward, and flowers with pollen and stalks and green leaves fell on her. Chula Subhadra thought, he let the flowers and pollen fall on the wife who was dear to him, but on me he dropped dry twigs, dead leaves and red ants. Well, I shall know what to do about that. And she conceived a grudge against the great being. And then a couple of events happened of a similar thought. Now, later on she gets some wild fruits and offers them to some Pacheka Buddhas. And she makes the wish. As she offers them, she makes the wish, may I, when I pass away from here, ito chavitva, may I be reborn as the royal maiden Subhadra in the mother king's family, and on coming to age may I attain to the dignity of queen consort to the queen, king of Benares. And then may I, I'll speak to the king and send a hunter with a poisoned arrow to wound and slay this elephant, and thus may be able to have brought to me a pair of his tusks that emit six coloured rays. And after that she did not eat, and pining away in no long time she died, and was reborn as a child of the queen consort in the mother kingdom, and was named Subhadra. So kind of interesting, this kind of notion of the dedication of merit and so on, that the merit that she made from offering to the Pacheka Buddhas was so great that even though her wish was so evil and so mean-spirited, it still was successful. And then she, the time came for her to, after she grew up and was married, to fulfill her wish. So then she anointed her body with common oil, put on a soiled robe, and lay in bed pretending to be sick. The king said, where is Subhadra? And hearing that she was sick, he entered the royal closet, and sitting on the bed, he stroked her back and uttered the first stanza. Notice that the soiled cloth here is kilittavattang, which is a this is the past participle of kilesa. So we're used to the word kilesa meaning defilement, but here's the ordinary language version, a soiled robe. And he said to the following words, O large-eyed and peerless one, my queen, so pale to grief a prey, like a wreath that's trampled underfoot, why fadest thou away? And then she spoke the second stanza, as it would seem all in a dream, a longing sore I had. My wish is vain this boon to gain, and that is why I'm sad. Okay, so she's making up that she's got this in a dream, and she's had a dohala. The king said, all joys to which in this glad world a mortal may aspire, whate'er they want his mind to grant, so tell me thy desire. On hearing this, the queen said, great king, my desire is hard to attain. I will not now say what it is, but I would have all the hunters that there are in your kingdom gathered together. Then I will tell it in the midst of them. And to explain her meaning, she spoke the next stanza. Let hunters all obey the call within this realm who dwell, and what I fain from them would gain in their presence tell, I'll in their presence tell. The king agreed, and issuing forth from the royal chamber, he gave orders to his ministers, and saying, bring all the hunters together. They gathered 60,000 of them. The king, hearing that they'd come, came to the window, told the queen, and the queen spoke to the hunters. Ye hunters bold, assembled here, unto my words I pray give ear. Dreaming me thought, an elephant I saw, six tusked and white without a flaw. His tusks I crave and fain would have, nought else avails this life to save. The hunters, on hearing this, replied, ne'er in our sires in times of old a six-tusked elephant behold. Tell us what kind of beast might be that which appeared in dreams to thee. And then they asked him where it might be, which direction. After these words, Subhadra, looking at the hunters, spied among them one who was broad of foot, with a calf swollen like an alms basket, big in the knee and ribs, thick bearded, with yellow teeth, disfigured, with scars, conspicuous among them all as an ugly, hulking fellow. His name was Sonuttara, and he'd once been an enemy of the Bodhisattva. And she thought, he will be able to do my bidding. Okay, so here's this great description of this hunter, not merely a hunter from the lowest caste, the man of violence and death, but the ugliest, most monstrous one himself. He's virtually a half a yaka. And so this is this image, we're coming very close to this image of the almost like the sort of crudest, most violent, primitive aspects of masculinity. This is what she's particularly picked out, and that's who is doing her bidding. She goes up and she gives him the directions. Okay, so I won't go into all of those verses of giving the directions. But on hearing it, he said, "Fair lady, I will kill the elephant and bring you his tusks." And then in her joy, she gave him 1,000 pieces and said, "Go home meanwhile, and at the end, 1,000 pieces of money. And at the end of 7 days, you shall set out." And she dismissed him, and she summoned smiths and gave them an order and said, "Sirs, we have need of an axe, a spade, an auger, a hammer, an instrument for cutting bamboos, a grass cutter, an iron staff, a peg, an iron three-pronged fork. We need a cordless drill, an angle grinder, so this is very interesting, this kind of list of tools. This is what all the contents of the hardware store is what this ugly hunter man, this primitive beast man, he is what he needs to be able to accomplish his task. Yeah. Then she said to the leather workers, "Sirs, you must make a leather sack. We have need of leather ropes and straps, shoes big enough for an elephant, and a leather parachute." "Make them all with speed and bring them to us." And they brought everything, and with firewood, all the appliances and necessities. And soon Sonodra came back, got the appliances, and he took up the huge weight of things like it was a bag of cakes, placed it on his hips, and stood with empty hands. So he's like, you know, he's like he's been to Kathmandu or Paddy Palin's. He's got himself his backpack, all the gear, he can put it on his back, and he's just like his hands are empty. We'll see later what's replying. I'm just trying to see where it is. Yeah.
But that doesn't seem too far-fetched. It's just something like parachuting and flying, air travel and coming out.
Yeah, there's a whole big compound there. Okay, anyway, we'll see.
That's what it's like.
We'll see what happens to him. All right. And then he went with a retinue and with many people through all the villages and hamlets and reached the frontiers. Then he turned back the people of the country and went on with the dwellers in the borders until he entered the forest, and passing quite beyond the haunts of men, he sent back the border people as well and proceeded quite alone on a road to a distance of 30 leagues. So this again is a very interesting motif. He's almost travelling backwards in time. Yeah, he's like successively going back through the different kind of layer, from the kings to the towns, from the towns to the villages, and then from the villages back into the forest. He's leaving behind the world of civilization, going back into the subconscious, if you will, and transcend, and then went into a dense grove of tukusa grasses and thickets of basil, reeds and rest harrow, and Annie, you might want to study the biology of this later. It goes on to quite a few. There are dense forests which is even a snake could not penetrate through.
There must be
okay. The jungles of grass he cut with a sickle, the thickets of basil and so on he cleared with his instrument for cutting bamboos, the trees he felled with an axe, and the oversized ones he first pierced with an auger. Then pursuing his way, he fashioned a ladder in the bamboo grove, and climbing to the top of the thicket, he laid a single bamboo which he had cut over the next clump of bamboos, and thus creeping along the top of the thicket, he reached a morass. So that's how he got it through the bamboo thicket. Then he spread a dry plank on the mud, and stepping on it, he threw another plank before him, and so crossed the morass, like the quicksand, the mud. Then, so this
sounds like the landscape, you know, the southern
Nepal. Yeah.
It's very low lying, and it's very swampy, and it's got all that type of vegetation.
Could be, yeah.
And it's fairly, very, you know, lots of malaria, and we used to be unprotected because of the southern Pacific. If you're heading from, Bob Dyer or something like that, or polar Khasi to the mountains, you have to go through that.
Yeah, it's probably quite a realistic description.
And they also would have lots of elephants there.
And this is very reminiscent of the Odyssean style of hero, the one who can overcome all the obstacles through his not just through his strength and bravery, but also through his cleverness. Then he made a canoe and by means of it he crossed the flooded region and at last stood at the foot of the mountains. Then he bound a three-pronged grappling iron with a rope, and flinging it aloft, he caused it to lodge fast in the mountain. Then climbing up by the rope, he drilled the mountain with an iron staff tipped with diamond, and knocking a peg into the hole, he stood upon it. Drawing out the grappling iron, he once more lodged it higher than the mountain, and from this position let the leather rope hang below. He took hold of it and descended and fastened the rope on the peg below. Seizing the rope with his left hand and taking the hammer in his right, he struck a blow on the rope, and having thus pulled out the peg, he once more climbed up. In this way he mounted the top of the first mountain, then commencing his descent on the other side, having knocked as before a peg into the top of the first mountain and bound the rope on his leather sack, wrapping it round the peg, he sat within the sack and let himself down, uncoiling the rope like a spider letting out his thread. This is the first ever description of abseiling that's ever found in. Okay, and now this is a lovely little bit here. Okay, so all of this kind of stuff he's been through. Okay, now then, all without a cordless drill, exactly. Okay, so then, letting his leather parachute catch the wind, he went down like a bird. Or at least, that's what they say. That's just what they say. Yeah?
You were mentioning about that last time, or so they say, is when they're not sure.
Yeah, normally they use a particle kira. This is a particular idiom I haven't found elsewhere, Vedanti Yeva. That's just what they say, literally. That's literally what it says, Vedanti Yeva.
This
is like
a
Icarus
type of
thing. So, okay. Then there's the verses that retell the thing. Okay. The hunter, after 7 years, 7 months, and 7 days, having reached the dwelling place of the great being in the manner related above, took note. So this is why it's to note you when you're reading mythology and things like that. This is why you learn to recognize. These are like signposts. So when it says 7 years, 7 mountains, 7 months, 7 days, it's telling you we're in mythic space here. This is not a date, right? Don't interpret this in terms of a calendar. This is how the stories convey these things to you.
What's the festival about the number
Number seven is very, you know, it's so widespread all through mythology. It obviously has a very, very fundamental meaning, but the basic meaning is usually traced to astronomy. There's seven visible planets, including the sun and the moon, and seven's also the division of the lunar cycle, the quarter of the lunar cycle. So that's sort of the basis of the week. So this is that idea. It's always like the cosmic cycle. So you can see like he's gone to the end of the world by doing this thing, you know. He's crossed over everything. He's gone beyond our world into another realm. So that's a crossing over. Or even like the 7 days in the story of Genesis, you know, it's like the creation of the whole world and cosmos. So this is typically what the meaning is in mythology.
Should we read that also in the Satipatthana?
Possibly.
These teachings in 7 days.
7 days, yeah.
7 months, 7 weeks, 7 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, similar. I mean, it's a similar idiom, for sure. Okay, so... And of course, you know, when we're interpreting these things, I mean, it doesn't mean that it's like, you know, Freud said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. So just because something's, just because something is, has a mythological dimension, or possible interpretation, doesn't mean that it is should be interpreted in a symbolic way. But in cases like this, it's like told us that it's symbolic. It's not just it took him 7 days to do it, but it's 7 years, 7 months, 7 days. So in these cases, we can't ignore it. You can't pretend. The hunter took a note of the elephant's dwelling place and dug a pit there, thinking, I will take my stand here and wound the Lord of Elephants and bring about his death. Thus did he arrange matters, went to the forest and cut down trees to make posts and prepared a lot of material. And when the elephants went to bathe in the spot where the king elephant used to stand, he dug a square pit with a huge mattock. And the soil that he dug out he sprinkled on the top of the water as if he was sowing seed. And on the top of stones like mortars he fixed posts and fitted them with weights and ropes and spread planks over them. Next, he made a hole of the size of an arrow and drew on the top earth and rubbish, and on one side he made an entrance for himself. And so when the pit was finished, at break of day he fastened on a false topknot and donned robes of yellow, the kasaya, ochre robes, and taking his bow and a poisoned arrow, he went down and stood in the pit. Okay, so he's like a pit, he's disguised it, and he's disguised not only the pit, he's disguised himself as a rishi. So this motif of the hunter, the killer, and the sage and the rishi wearing the kasaya is something you find constantly through these Jataka stories. Okay, so then in the verses it says, the pit with planks he first did hide, then bow in hand he got inside, and as the elephant passed by, a mighty shaft the wretch let fly. The wounded beast loud roared with pain, and all the herd roared back again. Crushed boughs and trampled grass betray where panic flight directs their way. Their lord had well nigh slain his foe, so mad with pain was he, when lo, a robe of yellow met his eyes, emblem of sainthood, priestly disguise, and deemed inviolate by the wise. In other words, you couldn't kill him because he's wearing the yellow robe. Okay. Then the great being, where are we now? Extinguishing. His pacifying his mind towards him, tasmin chittan nibbapetva. Okay, so literally the nibbapetva is the verb form of nibbana. So he nibbanaed his mind. In other words, he'd quelled or settled any thoughts of anger or something towards the hunter, and said to him, "Why did you wound me? What was it? Was it for your own advantage, or were you acting on the orders of someone else?" And the hunter told him, "It was the king of Kasi's favoured queen, Subhadra, told me she had seen thy form in dreams, and so said she, I'll have his tusks, go bring them me." Hearing this, and recognising that this was the work of Chula Subhadra, his previous wife, this is Chula Subhadra's kama, he bore his sufferings patiently and thought, "She does not want my tusks, she sent him because she wants to kill me." And to illustrate the matter, he uttered a couple of stanzas. A rich store of goodly tusks have I, relics of my dead ancestry. And this well knows that cursed dame. 'Tis at my life the wretch does aim. Rise, hunter, or here I die, sore off these tusks of ivory. Go bid the shrew be of good cheer. The beast is slain, his tusks are here. Having heard his words, the hunter rose up from the place where he was sitting, and with his saw in his hand, he still got his tools with him, everything he does, came close to him to cut off his tusks. Now the elephant, being like a mountain 80 cubits high, was but ineffectually cut, for the man could not reach to his tusks. So the great being, bending his body towards him, lay with his head down. Then the hunter climbed up the trunk of the great being, pressing it with his feet as though it were a silver rope, and stood on his forehead as if he'd been a Kailasa peak, Mount Kailash. Then he put his foot in the mouth of the elephant, and striking the fleshy part of it with his knee, he climbed down from the beast's forehead and shoved the saw into his mouth. The great being suffered excruciating pain, and his mouth was filled with blood. The hunter, shifting about from place to place, was still unable to cut the tusks with his saw. So the great being, letting the blood drop from his mouth, resigning himself to the agony, asked, saying, "Sir, can't you cut them?" And when he said no, he recovered his presence of mind. He said, "Well then, since I myself have not strength enough to raise my trunk, you lift it up for me and let it seize the end of the saw." The hunter did so, and the Bodhisattva seized the saw with his trunk, moving it backwards and forwards, and he himself cut off the tusks as though they were sprouts. Then bidding him take the tusks, he said, "I don't give you these, friend hunter, because I do not value them, nor as one desiring the position of Sakamara or Brahma. But for me, the tusks of omniscience are 100,000 times dearer than these to me, and may this meritorious act be for me the cause of attaining omniscience." And he gave him the tusks and said, "How long were you coming here?" He said, 7 years, 7 months, and 7 days. Then he said, "Go by the magic power of these tusks and you can reach Benares in just 7 days." And he gave him conduct, safe conduct, and let him go.
What's the word in Upanishad for omniscience?
Sabhanyuta.
Is that what it means?
Yeah, Sabhanyuta, all-knowing, yeah. And after he sent him away before the other elephants and Subhadra had returned, he was dead. So obviously very sad, very kind of pathetic scene there with the elephant dying and so on. It's one of the most sort of tear-jerking, weepy scenes that you'll find in all of the Jatakas. Yeah. And this one particularly reminds me of the whole Jesus story. You know, the kind of the belaboring, the death and the pain and all of these kinds of things. Yeah, but this is one of the later Jatakas. So in the last book of the Jatakas, the literary qualities really start to be brought out. So then the other. Well, yeah, hard to say. They're collected at 400 AD or so. Yeah, probably mostly between, I don't know, maybe 100 BC or something, generally around that. Yeah. But, you know, you can see here, clearly, you've got something more than just a casual folk tale told around the campfire or something like that. You know, you've got
all the details about climbing. I mean, I always wondered, you know, in the Himalaya, there's places where Buddhist monks and nuns obviously went, you know, over 2,000 years ago, you know, pre-Gandharan type sutras and stuff like that. And to get there must have been incredibly difficult. Yeah. You know, really involved in climbing and going through all this.
Yeah.
So that description of that is, I thought, it's very fascinating. That's why I don't know if anybody knows Tim McCartney's house, is it? Sounds like Tim McCartney. He actually did that. He went from sea level to top of Everest, all on foot, sea to summit. That's where that sea to summit brain comes from. I don't know if anybody's heard of that. I think it's pretty amazing. Australians, the first Australian to climb, I think. but sort of similar heroic feat.
Yeah. Okay, so then they came with Subhadra and they all lamented for the passing of the Bodhisattva. They went to the Pacheka Buddhas and they told them, and then they raised up the body of the king elephant with their tusks, and they made the body, they made the body, the dead body, pay homage to the Pacheka Buddhas. Then they raised it aloft on a pyre and burned it, and the Pacheka Buddhas recited the mantras all night, and then they all returned to their abode. Now then,
is the elephant like that some in the sort of music or in the Jata stories?
Isn't the same kind of imagery used for the bird story of the Buddha?
Exactly.
Is the six tusks as well?
And how long was it last year?
It's the same kind of six-tusked elephant that appears in Maya's dream just before the Buddha's born. And, so it's very interesting to see that here, like imagining the Buddha's life, you find the Bodhisattva is depicted in the same image, whether it be in the dream of Maya or in the actual form that he's supposed to have taken in the past life. He's a white elephant with six tusks. What I would suggest here as an interpretation is that the six-tusked elephant, in a Jungian interpretation, is clearly contrasting with the hunter. And the elephant represents the noblest and the highest aspects of masculinity. He's the just king who rules all with kindness and keeps the safety, whereas the hunter represents the lowest aspects of masculinity. And we'll see a different relationship between these two later on. So this story fails because those two, the higher masculinity and the lower masculine figure, weren't resolved. Yeah, they didn't connect. Their relationship was one of violence and transgression, and so this is why this particular story fails. So remembering that all of this is sent out, as it were, from the mind of the queen. Okay, so this whole story is something which the queen has instigated and which has been sent out in her mind.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the importance of a proportional response. Then, sorry, can I just go on? Let me just finish. We're nearly at the end, okay? And then when the verse comes, then the hunter went straight to Kasi Hais, bearing his bright and matchless prize, the noble creature's tusks, I mean, cheering all hearts with golden sheen. And to that royal dame, he said, here is his tusks, the beast is dead. I love these verses, they're just absolutely fantastic. No one would ever write like that anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, in offering them to the queen, he said, lady, the elephant against whom you conceived a grudge in your heart for a trifling offence has been slain by me. Do you tell me that he's dead? She cried, and he gave her the tusks, saying, be assured, he is dead. Here are his tusks. She received the tusks adorned with six different coloured rays on her jewelled fan, and placing them on her lap, gazed at the tusks of one who in a former existence had been her dear lord. And she thought, this fellow has come with the tusks he cut from the auspicious elephant that he slew with a poisoned shaft. And at the remembrance of the great being, she was filled with such great sorrow that she could not endure it. But her heart then and there was broken, and that very day she died.
And she asked for the elephant to be killed, or she just wanted the tusks?
No, she wanted him to be killed.
Yeah, oh.
Sometimes you don't want to get what you want. So that's the power of that story, is that in this case her dohala was fueled by this evil wish, a wish for vengeance and for death. And of course the outcome of that was destruction and death for everyone concerned. Oh, because it's very close to the archetypes, yeah? The whole six-tusked elephant and everything like that. Yeah, so the higher form doesn't mean good. High is different from good. Yeah. So even some of the lower ones, there's like a successful outcome or a good outcome. So, but that's a really critical point in mythology, is that the height or the pitch of a myth has got nothing to do with the ethical qualities of it, mm. which is something that almost completely gets misunderstood, that we read these things for the moral of the story rather than seeing it for the actual... See, this is, in a sense, I'd say that's also a high myth in the sense that it almost succeeds. Like that, the hunter is almost a great hero. Mm. He's actually accomplished all of these incredible feats and everything like that. Mm. And he's actually right at that point where he almost could have been a tremendous hero, but just at the last minute he fails. Yeah. And I should mention, of course, the identification of the birth right at the end. Blah, blah, blah. Interesting, it has, instead of the straight identification, it has a series of verses and so on. But the main thing is, of course, the queen was the young bhikkhuni of that time, and the hunter was Devadatta. Alright, so let's get on to have a look at a few more of the high forms, and now we're going to be looking at some of the truly archetypal images, and we'll start with the image of the golden peacock.
Before we go,
just
pointing out that in this case, in the relation between the low and higher masculine, not only does the lower fail, but the higher self as well, the bodhisattva, the elephant, actually fails.
Because
he chooses to engage in the situation just by giving up and sawing himself to bits.
And you don't think that's adequate?
No. I don't think self-mutilation is a way of self-promotion.
Yeah, I mean, but this is why I think it's to me it's very much like the Jesus story. But in the Jesus story, of course, it is successful. You know, that is what actually wins. You know, that's the highest thing. But in the Buddha story, it's not. Okay, let's go. We don't have too much time, so I don't want to rush this, but we won't. Elephant book, ask Sinsin. The story was told at Jetavana, Mora Jataka 159, about a backsliding brahma. This bhikkhu was led by some others to the Buddha, and it said, "Is it true, monk, as I hear, that you have backslidden?" I don't know if that's an actual word. "Yes, sir. What have you seen that would make you do so?" "A woman dressed up in magnificent attire." "Then," said the master, "what wonder that womankind should trouble the wits of a man like you. Even wise men who for 700 years have done no sin, on hearing a woman's voice have transgressed in a moment. Even the holy become impure. Even they who have attained the highest honour have thus come to disgrace. How much more the unholy?" And he told a story of the times of old. Now, once upon a time, Brahmadatta was ruling in Benares. The bodhisattva came into this world as a peacock. The egg which contained him had a shell as yellow as a kanikara bud. And when he broke the shell, he became a golden peacock, fair and lovely, with beautiful red lines under his wings. To preserve his life, he traversed three ranges of hills, and in the fourth he settled on a plateau of a golden hill in Dandaka. When day dawned, as he sat upon the hill, watching the sun rise, he composed a Brahma spell, a Brahma mantra, to preserve himself safe in his own feeding ground, the charm beginning, "There he rises." So we're told explicitly that this is a Brahmanical mantra that he's reciting. And the verse, "There he rises, the one king,
all-seeing, Ekaraja, Chakrama, Ekaraja, very reminiscent of Vedic language, especially this phrase, Ekaraja. I'm not sure whether this actually is paralleled in any Vedic verses, but it very much sounds like it. Making all things bright with his golden light. Thee I worship, glorious being, making all things bright with thy golden light. Keep me safe, I pray, through the coming day. So this is a classic prayer. This is the archetypal form of all prayer, is that you start out with praise and then you ask for what you want. Right? Butter them up and then say, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, so on and so on. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, and so on and so forth. This is exactly the same form that supplicatory prayer takes everywhere and at all times. So here's this verse which sounds very much like it would be given as a Brahman mantra, very similar, for example, to the Gayatri mantra. Tatsavitur varenyam. And Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi, and so on. So then, worshipping the sun, okay, so it says Suryang Namisitwa, so the Bodhisattva is worshipping the sun. He then repeats another in worship of the Buddhas who have passed away and all their virtues. These saints, here using Brahmana in the Buddhist sense, the Vedagu, the righteous, the ones not the knowledge in the Dhamma, wise in the Dhamma. These do I honour and their aid implore. All honour to the wise, to wisdom honour be, to freedom and to all that freedom has made free. So this is having made this parita, then the peacock went feeding. Okay, so this is one of the early paritas, which is recited and still included in the paritas, that's chanted. But interesting to know how in this case, how blatant and how obvious the Buddhist overlay is. You know, we have the whole story is of this golden peacock, who himself is quite obviously a solar symbol. The very image of the golden egg which he's born out of, the Hiranyagarbha, is a classic Vedic image for the sun. The sun is the golden egg as the source of all life and so on. And so the peacock himself, you know, you can imagine the image of a golden peacock spreading his feathers in the morning light as the sun's rising, being a beautiful image of the sun and worshipping the sun. So here you have a pure solar myth of sun worship, and then, oops, this is a Buddhist story. We've got to shove a bit of Buddhism in there. We'll put a verse of homage to the arahants and so on, just to make sure everyone knows that it really is. We're not really just doing sun worship here. It actually is a Buddhist story. And so to me, this is one of the things that makes this story or this set of stories very interesting, is that the archetypes and the mythic dimension lies very, very close to the surface. Okay, where it's almost like it's breaking right through to the surface and almost like declaring itself for what it is. Okay. So after flying about all day, he came back in the evening, sat on the hilltop to see the sun go down, and as he meditated, I don't know what meditated he is here. I don't think it really means to meditate. Atangama. He uttered another spell to preserve himself and keep off evil, basically the same spell, except instead of saying there he rises, it says there he sets, the one king who sees all. Now there was a savage. Savage. Nirsada, word for savage here, who lived in a certain village of wild huntsmen near Benares. Wandering about in the Himalaya hills, he noticed the Bodhisattva perched on the golden hill of Dandaka and had told it to his son. And so again, this idea of the very primitive man, you know, and the contrast between that and the glorious image of the Bodhisattva.
What does it mean?
What?
A savage, is it a person?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
Haven't heard that word for a long time. Oh, well, this is a century old translation,
yeah,
they weren't worried about.
Nesada.
Means a savage. Now it so befell that on a day, it's the savages, it's in the primitive tribes living on the borders of civilization, they're the ones who catch a glimpse of this golden peacock. And remember that the golden peacock has gone there specifically to protect his own life. He's gone there for safety. Okay, it so befell that on a day, one of the wives of the king of Benares, who was called Kema, saw in a dream a golden peacock holding a religious discourse. This she told to the king, saying that she longed to hear the discourse of the golden peacock. The king asked his courtiers about it, and the courtiers said, "Well, the Brahmins will know about this." The Brahmin said, "Oh, yes, there are golden peacocks." And they said, "Where?" They replied, "The hunters will be sure to know." The king called the hunters together and asked them. And then one hunter answered, "O Lord King, there is a golden hill in Dandaka, and there a certain golden peacock lives. Then bring it here, kill it not, but just take it alive." Okay? So this is the hunter who'd heard the rumours from the savages.
Savage means uncivilized person.
Yeah. The hunter set snares in the peacock's feeding ground, but even when the peacock stepped upon it, the snare would not close. The hunter kept trying for 7 years, but catch him he could not, and then he died. The queen Kema, too, died without obtaining her wish. The king was angry because his queen had died for the sake of a peacock. He caused an inscription to be made upon a golden plate to this effect: "Among the Himalaya mountains is a golden hill in Dandaka. There lives a golden peacock, and whoever eats of its flesh becomes ever young and immortal." And he enclosed the plate in a casket. Okay, so the plot thickens. Before they were saying, "We'll just bring him back alive," and now they want to eat his flesh. But again, this is, this sort of combination of factors leading to this. You know, we've had the dream of a queen. You know, we've had this glimpse from some tribesmen in a village somewhere, and these kind of put building together this myth within the culture of this thing, and now it becomes the elixir of immortality. Of course, in many senses, the attaining of the immortal is the immortality is the core of every search. The quest, the spiritual quest, is always the search for what is going to take me beyond death. After his death, the next king read this inscription and he thought, "I will become ever immortal," and he sent another hunter. And of course, I should mention it also that the immortality is a classic characteristic of the sun. Okay, the sun as the immortal is always there, never changes.
In the casket, is that correct?
Enclosed in a casket. I'm not sure if
it's that the next king had to open up the casket, look at the rotting body, and take out the inscription.
I'm not sure. It doesn't say. I'm not sure what kind of casket. Yeah, it doesn't say coffin. Okay, then second king did the same thing. The hunter failed, and so on. And this way, the kingdom was ruled by 6 successive kings. And then arose a 7th king, who also sent forth a hunter. The hunter observed that when the golden peacock came into the snare, it did not close, and also that he recited a charm before a mantra before setting out in search of food. So this hunter has now evolved. He's not just using the ordinary hunting means, but he's using his brain as well. Off he went to the marches, and he caught a peahen. Which a peahen, a female peacock, which he trained to dance when he clapped his hands. Oh, and at a snap of his finger to utter her cry. And taking her along with him, he set the snare, fixing its uprights in the ground early in the morning before the peacock had recited his charm. And then he made the peahen utter a cry. And this sound, the voice of a woman, woke desire in the peacock's breast. Leaving his charm unspoken, he came towards her and was caught in the net. Then the hunter took hold of him and took him to the king of Benares. The king was delighted at the peacock's beauty and ordered a seat to be placed for him. Sitting in the proffered seat, the bodhisattva said, "Why have you had me caught, O king?" "Because they say that all that eat of you become immortal and have eternal youth, so I wish to gain youth eternal and immortality by eating your flesh." "So be it," he said. "But does that mean I have to die?" "But of course it does," said the king. And he said, "Well, if I die, how can my flesh give immortality to those that eat it?"
Your colour is golden, therefore, so it is said, those that eat your flesh become young and live forever. He said, Sir, there is a very good reason for my golden colour. Long ago, I ruled the whole world, reigning in this very city. I kept the five precepts and made all people of the world keep the same. For that, I was born after death in the world of the 33 archangels. The 33 gods. Then I lived out my life, but in my next birth I became a peacock in consequence of some bad karma. But however, the golden, I became gold because I had before kept the precepts. And one thing, as it says in the footnote here, that also one of the reasons for the association with immortality is because gold doesn't perish. On the same principle, pieces of jade are placed in the coffin of the Chinese to preserve the soul of the dead. Groot, in a work on Chinese religions, quotes a Chinese writer of the 4th century who says, he who swallows gold will live as long as gold, he who swallows jade will exist as long as jade. And he even recommends it for the living. So this is principles of sympathetic magic. And then he says, okay, that's what kind of story is that, right? So you've got this peacock telling you the story about how he ruled the world and that's how he came to be gold. King says, well, prove it. Or as it says in the text here, a proof, privy. Yes, it actually says privy here. Anyone wants to check? I have one, sire. What is it? Well, sire, when I was a monarch, I used to pass through midair seated in a jewelled car, which now lies buried in the earth beneath the waters of the royal lake. Okay, buried in the unconscious. Dig it up from beneath the lake, and that shall be my proof. The king approved the plan. He drained the lake and dug out the chariot, and he believed the bodhisattva. And bodhisattva addressed him thus, sire, except for nibbana, which is everlasting, all things else, being composite in their nature, are unsubstantial, transient, and subject to living and death. So this idea of the teaching of impermanence being an implicit critique of the Brahmanical philosophy, which the story was originally based on. Discoursing on this theme, he established the king in the keeping of the precepts. Peace filled the king's heart. He bestowed his kingdom upon the bodhisattva and showed him the highest respect. The bodhisattva then returned the gift. Okay, so the king says to the peacock, here, you have the kingdom. He says, sire, that's so wonderful. Here, you have the kingdom. And after staying for a few days, he rose in the air and flew back to the golden hill of Dandaka with a parting word of advice. O king, be careful. Appamatto. The king, on his part, kept the bodhisattva's advice and after giving alms and doing good, passed away to fare on according to his karma. Yataka mangato. Now, at that time, the Buddha said, after the telling of the story, of course, the backsliding brother realized the truths, and Ananda was the king of those days, and I myself was the golden peacock.
Who was the backslider?
Just a random backsliding monk. Yeah. No, but the queen's called Kema, and usually she's identified as the Bikuni Kema. Yeah. Let's check that.
Hunter went off to get the peacock because Kema wanted to listen to
the Dhamma.
The Dhamma, and that changed to the king wanting immortality.
Yeah.
But I was getting angry because she died about getting the rich, so they were getting angry.
It twisted as it went along. It's a bit like the one we read last week with the Naga Queen. You know, she actually also wanted the Dhamma, but it became misconstrued as she wanted the flesh of the heart. Yeah. So it gets kind of twisted as it goes along. So again, this is another kind of motif that you're seeing here, is that it's almost, the story is almost telling you that, it's almost saying that underneath the brutal surface of this story is really a genuine and very pure wish for Dhamma. Yeah, it's almost, you can see how the way the story is constructed, it's actually almost, it's almost unpacking itself. And again, this is one of the reasons why these particular stories are, I think, are almost like shining through the surface of the story and revealing the archetype. So that particular.
Do you think that the, like, yes, so there's the archetype.
there was a funny Christian story, and the Buddhist storytellers used that one to try and illustrate some drama.
Yep. Oh, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. So, for.
Go back to Jason's remark about this, the failure of the self-suffering, the entrance to
So it kind of connects that to high doesn't necessarily mean good.
Yeah.
You know, at a higher level, you can still be pathological and healthy.
Yeah. But in this story, it's peacock. Talked himself. I mean, killed peacock from the ground.
Yeah,
so he killed. Turned things around. In fact, he's an atom top on his side.
So I just have one time, probably enough time for one more, and just go to, yeah, the other gold picker one's quite similar. Okay, so I'll read one of the golden goose stories, Jataka 501, sorry, one of the golden deer stories, Jataka 501. So, and just to notice also, just with the previous one, that with here you had like a conjunction of the more sort of conventional idea of the rishi or the pure man who is corrupted by the woman, okay, but also the idea that the queen's wish was what ultimately brought the prosperity and righteousness to the realm. Yeah, so there's that whole ambiguity built in within the one story, that you had both that negative and positive side, just as you have, so that in a sense that's like the lower and the higher forms of femininity. One form of femininity is what brought the sensual and the distracting and all of those things, and the other form is the one that brings fruitfulness and blessings, just as you had the lower and higher form of masculinity, the hunter who's the killer, and also the king or the peacock who is righteous. Yeah? So both of all of that's included within that one story.
Are there any stories with the union between the low and high
feminine? I regard it as essentially a woman's archetype, in the sense that it's a projection of her longing, so it's a projection of her mind. And so the main story is actually the union of the lower and the higher masculine. It's like her resolute integration of her animus on a psychological level, whereas the union of the lower and higher feminine is something that happens within the male stories. So that's from the men's stories. It's their projection of womanhood. That's what happens. So in the classic one, of course, is the Cinderella story with the ugly stepmother and the beautiful princess or something like that. So those kinds of stories. So when the resolution happens between them. Okay. Okay. So this was about background was Ananda, who'd even given his life for the Buddha when the drunken elephant Dhanapala was released. And the Buddha said this also happened in past lives. Once upon a time, when Brahmadatta was king in Benares, his chief consort's name was Kema. And so again, Kema, very important. Her name appears again and again in these stories. So here, also always Kema in these ones where it's the highest, the archetype is closest to the surface. Her name is always Kema. At that time, what does Kema mean? Anyone know?
Refuge.
Safety. Security. Yeah? So we're coming very close to what I think is almost the deepest meaning of these stories. Safety. Bodhisattva was born in the Himalayan region as a stag. He was golden-hued and beautiful, and his younger brother named Chittamiga, or Dapple Deer, was also of the colour of gold, and so also his younger sister Sutana. Now the great being's name was Rohanta, and he was king of the deer, traversing two ranges of mountains. In the third, he lived beside a lake called Lake Rohanta and had a herd of 80,000 deer. He supported his parents, who were old and blind. again living in this mystical realm, far, far removed from humans. Remember, what are they doing this? Why are they going so far away? For safety. They're going beyond the realm of the hunter, beyond the realm where humans can come and get them, where they think they'll be safe by hiding, by protecting themselves, by putting barriers, ranges of mountains. But, of course, it never works, because the hunter will always find you. Now, a hunter who lived in a village of hunters near Benares came to the Himalayas and saw the great being. He returned to his village and on his deathbed told his son, "My boy, in such and such a part of our hunting ground there is a golden deer. If the king should ask, you may tell him of it." Exactly the same as the previous story. One day, Queen Kema, near the dawn, saw a dream, and this was the manner of that dream. A golden-coloured stag sat on a golden seat, and he discoursed to the queen on the Dhamma with a voice as sweet as honey, like the sound of the tinkling of a golden bell. She listened with great delight to this discourse. Before the discourse was ended, the deer arose and went away, and she awoke, crying out, "Catch me the stag!" Her attendants, hearing her cry, burst out laughing. "Well, the door's shut, the window's shut, not even a breath of air can get in, and my lady calls out to catch her the stag." By this time, she understood that it was a dream, but she said to herself, "If I say it is a dream, the king will not pay attention to me. But if I say it is my woman's craving, my dohala, he will attend to it with all care." Okay? So once the dohala comes in, then the blokes are completely, they just don't have a choice. They're finished. "I will hear the discourse of the golden stag." And she lay down as though sick. The king came in and said, "What is wrong with my queen?" "Oh, my lord, it is only my dohala." "What do you wish?" "Only my dohala. Oh, my goodness. What do you wish?" "I wish to hear the discourse of a righteous golden stag." "But, my dear, what you crave does not exist. There is no such thing as a golden stag." And she said, "If I don't get it, I will die right here." She turned her back to the king and lay still. The king thought, "Bugger. If there is one, it shall be caught." Then he questioned his courtiers and Brahmins just as in the peacock birth. Okay, so notice that the story here is actually referring over to the other one. It's so similar that they even refer to each other. Whether there were such things as golden deer. Finding that there were, he summoned the huntsman and asked, "Which of you has seen or heard of such a creature?" And he was told about it, gave him money for the expenses and so on. And the man said, "I will bring you his skin, and if I can't get that, at least I will bring his hair." So the man went out, found the stag, and then said, "Where shall I lay my snare so as to catch him?" He saw his place at the drinking place, twisted a stout cord of leather thongs and set it with a pole at the place where the bodhisattva came down to drink. Next day, the great being with the 80,000 deer during his search for food came to drink water at the usual ford. Just as he was going down, he was caught in the noose. Then he thought, "If I cry out with the cry of capture, all my troop will flee in terror without drinking." Although he was fast at the end of the pole, he stood pretending to drink as if he were free. Then the 80,000 deer had drunk and now stood clear of the water. Okay, so he's so solicitous is he for the care of his people that he won't even say he's been trapped. He'll wait for them to drink first. Again, notice that it's the leader's role, the king's role, is protection and safety for those under his care. When the 80,000, and this is a standard motif that occurs right through these stories, the golden goose and golden deer stories. When the 80,000 deer had drunk and now stood clear of the water, he jerked three times at the noose to break it if possible. The first time he cut his skin, the second time cut into his flesh, and the third time he strained a tendon so that the snare touched the bone. Then, unable to break it, he uttered the cry of capture. Only now did he cry out, and all the herd of deer fled terrified in three troops. Chittamiga, I think his brother, younger brother, probably Ananda, could not see the great being in any of the three troops. He said, "This danger which has come upon us has fallen upon my brother." And returning, he saw him caught fast there. The great being caught sight of him and said, "Don't stand there, brother, there's danger here." And he urged him to flee. And the brother said, "No, I will not go. My heart has drawn me near. I'm ready to lay down my life. I will not leave thee here." Then blind, with none to care for them, our parents both must die. Oh, go and let them live with thee. Oh, do not linger nigh. "No, no, Rohanta, I'll not go. My heart has drawn me near. I'm ready to lay down my life. I will not leave you here." He stood his stand, supporting the Bodhisattva on the right side, and comforted him. Sutana also, the young doe, ran about among the deer, but could not find her brothers anywhere. "This danger," she thought, "must have fallen upon my brothers." And she came back and also insisted on staying with him and wouldn't leave. Now the huntsman saw the deer scampering off and heard the cry of capture. "It must be the king of the herd is caught," he said, and tightening his girdle, he grasped the spear to give him the death and rang quickly up. The great being repeated the ninth stanza. "The furious hunter, arms in hand, see him approaching near, and he will slay us here today with arrow or with spear." Chitta did not flee, although he saw the man, but Sutana, not being strong enough to stand still, ran a little way for fear of death. Then, she thought, where shall I flee if I desert my two brothers? And so she returned again, renouncing her own life with death on her brow, and stood by the left side of her brother. When the hunter came up, he saw these three creatures standing together. A thought of compassion arose in his heart. Metta chittam upadetva. Seeing those, the thought of metta arose in his heart. A pitiful thought arose in him as he guessed that they were brothers and sisters born of one womb. "Only the king of the herd," he thought, "is caught in the snare. The other two are bound with the ties of honour. What kin can they be to him?" And then he asked the question, "What are these deer that wait upon the prisoner, though themselves free, nor for the sake of very life will leave him here and flee?" The Bodhisattva answered, "My brother and my sister, these are one same mother born. Not for the very sake of life will leave me here forlorn." At this words, his heart became even softer. Bhiyo so mattaya mudu chitto ahosi. Chitta, that royal stag, perceiving that his heart grew soft, said, "Friend hunter, do not imagine that this creature is a deer and no more. He is a king of 80,000 deer, one of virtuous life, tender-hearted to all creatures. Of great wisdom, he supports his sire and his mother and father, now blind and old. If you slay a righteous being like this, in slaying him you slay the mother, the father, my sister, and me, all five. But if you grant my brother his life, you bestow life on all five of us." When the hunter heard these words of Dhamma, he was glad at heart. Prasanna chitto. "Fear not, my lord, ma bhayi sami, ma bhayi." And then said the following verse, "So be it. Now I set you free, the parent fostering deer. His parents, when they find him safe, shall make a merry cheer." And then he said, "What do I want with the king and his honours? If I hurt this royal deer, either the earth will gape and swallow me up, or a thunderbolt will fall and strike me." Interesting, that particular motif there. You get to read this from a mythic term, that the he's looked after by both brother and sister, yeah. So he's both the masculine and feminine are all standing together with him, yeah. And they look together, they look after both mother and father, yeah? So both the masculine and feminine, both incorporated, yeah? But if the hunter transgresses against him, both the mother earth will swallow him up, or else the father sky will strike him down. Huh? It's very, very specific imagery. "So I will let him go." Approaching the great being, he pulled down the pole and cut the leather thong. Then he embraced the deer, laid him close to the water. Tenderly and gently he loosed him out of the noose. He joined the ends of the tendon and the lips of the flesh wound, and the edges of the skin, washed off the blood with water, pitifully chafed him again and again. By the power of his love and the great being's perfection, all grew whole again. Sinews, flesh and skin, hide and hair covered the foot. No one could have guessed where he had been wounded. The great being stood there, full of happiness. Peter looked on him and rejoiced and rendered thanks to the hunter in this stanza. Hunter, be happy now, and may thy kindred happy be, as I am happy to behold the mighty stag set free. Now the great being thought, is it of his own doing this hunter snared me at the bidding of another? And he asked the cause. The hunter said, my lord, I have nothing to do with you, but the king's consort Kema desires to hear your discourse of righteousness. Therefore I snared you at the king's bidding. That being so, my good friend, you did a bold thing to set me free. Come, bring me to the king, and I'll discourse before the queen. Indeed, my lord, kings are cruel. Who knows what may come of it? I don't care for any honour the king might show me. Go where you will. And so he said, he must bring him honour. So he said, so notice in previous ones he actually did go back, and some of them he goes back. Here he says, my friend, rub my back with your hand. He did so, and his hand became covered with golden hairs. Yeah, so it's a very kind of specific image of how he's been transformed. He's actually taking on the physical characteristics of that contrast between the lower masculine, the hunter, and the higher masculine of the deer, and that protective the leader, the righteous king, who looks after his herd with such kindness. He's now transformed with metta, the heart of the hunter, and so the hunter's actually even taking on the physical characteristics as well. So he said, what shall I do with these hairs? He says, take them, my friend, show them to the king and queen. Tell them, here are hairs from the golden stag. Take my place and discourse of them in the words of verses. I shall repeat, when she hears you, that alone will be sufficient to satisfy her craving. And so the deer taught him various verses. And then the three deer went back to look after their parents. And they told them their story. Then when the hunter went back, he spoke to the king and the queen and said, the royal stag, O king, showed me his hairs. And told me to he told me to take his place and to teach the Dhamma, and then he taught the Dhamma. The queen's craving was satisfied. The king was pleased and repeated these stanzas as he rewarded the huntsman with great honour and gave him various gifts. But the hunter refused them. He says, I do not wish for house or home. Grant me, my lord, to become an ascetic. To the king's consent given, he handed over the king's rich gifts to his wife and family and went away to the Himalaya, where he embraced the ascetic life, cultivated the eight attainments, and became destined for Brahma's world. And the king clung to the Bodhisattva's teaching and went to swell the hosts of heaven. The teaching endured for 1,000 years. Okay, what do we got? Okay, the Channa was the huntsman. Channa the charioteer. Yeah. So he put to the king. The queen Kema was the bhikkhuni Kema. Some of the king's family were mother and father. Upalavana was Sutana. So the doe was Upalavana. Ananda was Chitta. And the Sakyan clan were the 80,000 deer. I myself was the royal stag Rohanta. No, I don't have time to read any more whole ones. But there's just one specific motif that I'd just like to bring out more clearly. Okay. So this is the 482, which is the other golden deer one. Very similar in many respects. It's actually, and then, but in this case, the deer himself speaks with the king. So at the end of the teaching, he offers him a boon. Okay, so he says to the king, offers the deer a wish. I'll give you anything you wish. And the deer replies, the cry of jackals and of birds is understood with ease, but the word of men, O king, is harder far than these. A man may think, this is my friend, my comrade, my kin, but friendship goes and hate and enmity begin. When the king heard these words, he answered, "O king of the deer, do not suppose that I am one of that kind, for I will not deny the boon I have promised you, not even if I lose my kingdom for it. Trust me." And he gave him the choice of a boon. The great being accepted this at his hands and chose this. So this is his wish. He's given whatever he wants, like Karen Armstrong, given whatever she wants. Okay? And the same wish, actually. That all creatures, beginning with himself, should be free from danger. So that's the wish. All creatures should be free from danger. The king granted this wish and then took him to Benares, and having adorned and decorated the city, and the great being also had him teach to the queen. And he did so, where he then went back to the woodlands. The king sent a drum beating around the city with his proclamation, "I give protection to all creatures." From that time onwards, no one dared so much as raise a hand against beast or bird. Okay, so this is another very, very important one. Actually, this is implicit previously, because it's always said that they then adopted the five precepts, yeah, which would include the precept against killing. But here it's now bringing it out even more explicitly. And so that is the ultimate outcome of this quest, is safety for all. All the beasts now have the safety. Yeah? And remember, you know, to me this is why this is so beautiful, because the deer or the peacock or whatever has gone so far away from mankind, trying to find safety, protected by all the mountains, everything they can put around themselves, and yet the hunter always finds them. Yeah? So as long as you're cut off, yeah, you can stay there for a while, you can be safe for a while, but eventually it's going to find you. But it's only when they go back that they then resolve and they integrate all of those things, then there's the true safety. So this is, of course, why the Queen Kema, yeah, Queen Safety is her name. And so again, while you find in the stories where it talks about the lower femininity, or she's always the woman for the ascetic, or for the higher masculine figure, is always dangerous. Yeah, in terms of the lower femininity, the sensuality. But this aspect of femininity that's presented here, she is precisely Queen Kema, the Queen of Safety. And it's only through her and through fulfilling her wish that safety is brought to all. Then they go back, they live in the forest, the hunters won't go there anymore. Very beautiful.
What? You've just gotten too used to rhyming about that.
Yeah, I know. It's just, you know. Herds of, okay, but then it goes on. There was a problem. Practical problem. Herds of deer devoured the crops of mankind and no one was able to drive them away. All right, that's the problem. A crowd assembled in the king's courtyard and complained. Hearing this, the king recited a couple of stanzas. "Be it the people's wish or not, even if my kingdom cease, I cannot do wrong to the deer to whom I promised life and peace. The people may desert me, or my royal power may die. That wish I granted the royal deer, I never will deny." The people listened to the king's words, and finding themselves unable to say anything, they departed. This tale was told about. The great being heard of it, and assembling all the deer, he laid his wish upon them. "From this time forward, you must not devour the crops of men." Then he sent a message to men that each should set up a placard on his own lands. The placard is actually a sanya, a sign, on their own lands. The men did so, and at that sign, even to this day, the deer do not devour the crops. So another very, very, this is the covenant. Yeah? This is another very, very important thing. Yeah? Just as in the Old Testament, God sets the rainbow in the sky as a covenant. Yeah? So this is now the agreement. So before you had the state of the wild, the primitive state of nature, where there was hunting and there was fear, yeah, everyone was out for everybody else, yeah? And now we have the covenant, we have the agreement. Everybody sees, they will understand each other. They can see and respect each other, respect each other's dignity, and they have that agreement, that covenant. Oh, okay, we will respect each other's rights. So they will each look after each other. When the lion lies down with the lamb, you can have a happy ending in the stories.
The stories that other creatures, but there are other creatures. Does it say anything about the creatures killing each other?
It doesn't say about creatures killing each other here, yeah. Okay, so at that time Ananda was the king and I myself was the deer. Okay, so that's another version of the golden deer. So gives you a reasonably good survey of a particular myth, particular archetype. And the thing that for me is very significant about this is that if we understand that symbol of the golden deer or the golden peacock and so on as the symbol I suggested of the higher masculinity, which is often represented by the ascetic. And in these stories, often the ascetic is the one who retreats to the Himalayas and to the mountains and so on, just as the peacock is seeking safety and protection. And of course, that's exactly what monks do, isn't it? Monks go off into the mountain, try to find a monastery where they don't have to see anybody or do anything, and you can find safety by putting up all the walls. So you put up the walls of the vineyard, the walls of the monastery rules, the walls of the rituals, the procedures, the traditions, all of these things that create kind of safety, and even, of course, the physical isolation by retreating into the jungle and the caves and things like that. But the hunter will always find you. Sorry? In Buffalo. The tourist buses will always find you, yes.
Is that how lay people perceive the monastic at the time?
In the way that they're watching?
Like, is that how, you know, they, Indian, kind of local people see monastic people just running off, looking for safety, but they don't actually find it? Is it their perception at that time, that's why they write this kind of story?
No, I don't think it's, possibly to some degree, it is their perception, but I think more importantly, it's the perception of the monks themselves. So I'm speaking now about contemporary life and about monks that I know. That's how monks think. And that's how they see. Whether nuns see things the same way, I don't know. But certainly for among the monks, that's very much how they see things.
Could this be commentary on the symbology of the deer and the bear?
It's certainly related to that, yeah.
It's Mara who's hunting, who's the hunter.
Yeah. Yes, it's related to the same kind of imagistic kind of set of ideas, yeah, for sure.
Are there any judges about carnivorous animals?
Of course, yeah. Plenty of lions and jackals,
but,
all kinds of
crocodiles.
Yeah, of course. The bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are often born as a lion.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. King of beasts.
It's interesting that the Queen's names came up because it kind of stacks that, you know, the desire for safety is not a bad thing. The desire to protect and the desire for safety, you know, they're the highest of principles. It's just the way that we go about it. Which is the problem.
Yeah. So that's why I found this particular group of stories very, very powerful and very important, I think, for understanding monastic psychology and sometimes why these fears and so on come, and how it's not to, the idea is not to say that the hiding is necessarily wrong. It sort of wasn't wrong for the peacock and the deer and so on to go off and hide themselves. Yeah? It's not criticizing that. It's merely saying that it's uncertain. It's limited. Yeah, just hiding by itself, you never overcome your fears.
But the archetype is the hunter and the deer is the higher masculine, and the hunter is the lower masculine. But they always will be together though. In the end, I mean, you can't have one male.
Yeah.
They'll have a balance of.
They're not within the male. Those two are within the female. According to the interpretation that I'm putting forward here, that from a Jungian point of view, this is primarily a woman's story. The lower and higher masculine are her images of masculinity.
Who's?
Her.
Any her.
Yeah, but especially Kama's, yeah? But you're quite true that both the lower and higher are always there. Just as you have both the reptilian stem and the, you know, frontal cortex and stuff.
Wherever they exist, if you're talking about masculine home, like escaping to the mountains or getting all further away, you'll never ever escape.
So that's why, and that's like another one of the devices of myth, because it renders everything impossible. So they've taken, you know, it's just like seven ranges of mountains and it's so secluded, it's impossible to get there. The very fact that it's impossible is what makes it completely inevitable.
That's why you have to have heroes.
Exactly. Yeah. So I really should get going now. We've got to get off to this talk. So thank you for putting up with me for this series of talks on Jataka stories. And so hopefully, if nothing else, suggested that within these stories that there's a little bit more to them than just a little morality tale, and that they do have things which can teach us. And just to suggest that, I'm not sure if I made this in the first thing, but just to emphasize again that in some way these Jatakas have been so important within the Buddhist tradition that, you know, we can critique them and say, well, it's not authentic Buddha Vachana, but in a sense that's kind of missing the point. We're like, we have to get over that. That's, yeah, okay, we know that as a matter of fact, but why are they there? They must have fulfilled some need for people. Okay, they're doing something which maybe is not addressed or which is not accessible through, say, the teachings of the suttas or something like that. They're speaking to people in a way that somehow the teachings of the suttas are not. It's not to say that the suttas are kind of lacking something or anything like that. It's just to say it's like a different way of approaching the truth, which can maybe address things from a different angle.
There's a lot more questions.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in a much longer discussion about it, particularly relating the archetypes in this with some of the ones in, you know, Greek mythology.
Yeah.
That are quite different, and I mean, I'm sort of interested, much more interested in what the archetypes are like in the, you know, the Vedic mythology. I mean, I know nothing about that thing. Because they, like the deer is so.
The deer is quite amazing. Yeah. I mean, just one thing about the deer is that the deer is very often the first sacrificial animal. The first sacrifice is the killing of the deer in Vedic mythology. Mm.
So
not always, but often. And you know, like the deer skin or the antelope skin is what's worn by the rishis, like the primal rishis like Shiva and so on. Yeah. So it's very important, obviously, an important animal. Anyway, look, that's a good idea, and we should definitely have that discussion. Let's do it on another day, and maybe we can arrange to have a discussion about those things.